Welcome, everyone. This is The LaRue Show. It's Saturday, September 15th, 2007. My name is Marcia Mary Baker. I will be the host today. I'm with the Economic Sector, co-editor for Economics of Executive Intelligence Review News Service. And today, we are at history-making points in many respects regarding the financial monetary breakdown process internationally, but strategically being able to do something about it. The topic that we listed for our show is Tell Congress Not a Penny to the Hedge Funds, Let the Queen Bail Them Out. And that refers to the process of getting Congress to face reality, because we need federal intervention with the situation in the United States, where more and more chaos is developing and harm and damage from the home mortgage bubble blowout of Alan Greenspan and those types. So with us today, we have two people from the LaRouche Youth Movement leading the charge in the United States. We have John Hoeffel. Welcome, John. Are you there?
Yes.
From the also economic section of Executive Intelligence Review, who's an expert on knowing your enemy, the British East India Company pedigree behind who's doing the damage. And so I welcome with me live in the studio, Kevin Evers. Hi, Kevin.
Hello.
And Kevin's with the LaRouche Youth Movement War Room. He's been so for several weeks. But off-site in Houston, Texas, we welcome Chris Landry. Hi.
How are you?
And Chris is just back, in the last few days from Austin, Texas, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where, as I say, from the front lines, the LaRouche Youth Movement have been leading the charge on Congress. It's not a contradiction that Austin, Texas, or Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, or Lansing, Michigan is where the action's been this week. So in just, I have one announcement, and then we'll go right to the LaRouche Youth War Room spokesman, Kevin, for an overview of what the battle is, and everyone should be familiar with this proposed emergency legislation called the Homeowners and Bank Protection Act of 2007, that on last week's LaRouche show, we had Mr. LaRouche himself for 8 minutes in a taped message from that day saying the system is cracking up, we have to get Congress to face it and act by September, no later than October or else. So we'll get to that, but everyone, there may be several thousands of people be listening now or soon after the show on the archived website who thought we might have guests direct from the conference now taking place in Germany on the banks of the Rhine River. It's, in fact, in Kiedrich, where there's a conference on the Bering Strait Tunnel and the Eurasian Land Bridge perspective on world reconstruction. Day one of that two-day conference is just finishing up, just as our show is on. But they were all involved there in this conference, so there is no live transmission from it. But either next week, that will be September 22nd on the LaRouche show with Harley Schlanger, we'll be able to have some tape for that, or some people who participated in that. Or otherwise, make sure and watch the www.schillerinstitute.org, or watch our LaRouche Pub, LaRouche Publications website, LaRouchePub.com, or of course the LaRouche Political Action Committee website, LaRouchePAC.com, and see what the updates of this conference are. But I want to just give you one very brief update that the number of people gathered there are about 350, and that represents 40 nations. The Americas are represented by over 26 people from 12 states in the United States. There's Canadian representation from Montreal. Mexico has a representation for people from Mexico City. And the deliberation during the day with Mr. LaRouche himself, with Helga Zepp LaRouche, the host of the conference, and with people from the Ministry for Economic Development from Russia, with people from Scandinavia, with people from North America here, Hal Cooper, some of you know him. He's a transportation expert based in Seattle. People are discussing the concretes of economic development, both in Eurasia and what that means for Africa, for the Americas. And tomorrow will be, that's Sunday the 16th, on technologies, including a special presentation of an update on fusion power by Mr. Steve Dean by a video. And I could go through the other speakers, but you get an idea of the sense of the gathering and the discussion taking place. So by way of introduction to Kevin Evers telling us where things stand here in the battle in the United States for a policy shift, let me just mention that Mr. LaRouche, speaking there at this Bering Strait Eurasian Land Bridge conference in Kiedrich in Germany, said a few hours ago that what we need is really two firewalls, given the breakdown process, the conflagration of the financial system breaking down. One, we need an emergency, almost an instantaneous firewall to protect people's lives, to protect them having a place to live, and to protect our banking system as a place to get credit and keep the economy function instead of sharks. So we need an emergency firewall, and that's what this proposal is for a Homeowners and Banks Protection Act. But secondly, we need another firewall. So we need two firewalls. The second one is we need emergency measures that will help us in the transition from a monetarist system of looting and gouging and sharking and instead have a monetary system that serves the real economy so that we can reconstruct physical infrastructure and the conditions of life around the globe. So with those two ideas, let's just jump in and ask Kevin to give an overview of the, maybe you can start with the irony that it's not just dealing with Congress on Capitol Hill, but you're really bringing pressure to them from around the country.
Yeah, so I think what you're saying, you know, the two fronts in the war that we have going on. And he said, at the beginning of this month, he said, I mean, our first task here, the immediate task, is to get Congress to introduce this bill by September, or there might not be a country left. It's going to happen that quick, and we've seen that unfold since then. And so people around the country are responding, especially on the grassroots side of things in the regions, your state and city government officials. As I think Lynn responded to a question at this conference in Germany, that the FDR tradition is in the United States, but it's not in the leadership of the Democratic Party. It's at the base of the party. It's at the grassroots part of this party, who are wondering why Congress is not acting, you know, just not on the impeachment of Cheney, but now on the fact that we're getting kicked out of our homes, all for the sake of saving hedge funds, you know, which are imaginary industries which can't be saved anyway. People are realizing and telling us now that these things, yeah, they're bankrupt. And so why is Congress doing this? And we're looking into this aspect of how you have hedge fund lobbyists putting just monstrous pressure on our federal congressmen. But we're also having a huge effect in authority because, I mean, we're not lobbyists for the Queen. I mean, we're there talking about the general welfare and something that's very universal to needs of human beings everywhere. And so we have now, this week, we've speared it out with saying we're going to get some endorsements on this bill this week. Because, like we said, we have till September. And so as of this week so far, I mean, we have four endorsements, and a couple are on our website already. And this is being crossfired, I mean, from the regions, the war room, to Washington, D.C. We're going to let congressmen know what's going on in their districts. So,
could you mention one of those is from, these are state level, like Missouri, right?
Yes. Missouri, Louisiana, we have some state legislators, and a former congressman from
Indiana, I think.
Indiana.
Andy Jacobs. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And because, I mean, the paradox in these meetings comes up real quickly. I mean, people are might be a little stubborn, saying, oh, people made bad decisions, whether it's the homeowners or the lenders. But then they're realizing, okay, it's not either one. It is systemic. And now we're getting to the point of really knowing what that means when we'll get a specific intention driving it to actually block a solution, which comes from the Cayman Islands, the hedge funds, and London. So it's having a real good effect, I think, of getting people really on the stage of history to know that this isn't some recent thing. This has been a fight that's been going on for a long time, and it's a fight on what it means to be human. Because why would we sacrifice you know, human beings and families, kick them out on the street for some mathematical, you know, system of economics. And it's a, I think, to go back to the crossfire then, which really proves how human beings can work together right now for a common cause. I mean, one thing that we put out this week, I think most people have emailed this thing or talked about it to them with various institutional figures, is this top 100 foreclosure list of cities, which encompasses almost the entire United States. So it's not too exclusive. But
so this, and mentioned that people, this was put together by, I think it's updated in August by some agency like Realty Track. It is Realty. Mm-hmm. Stockton, California has something like the highest. They would, it's rank ordered by.
Yeah, they're the foreclosure capital.
Okay. And they have something like one home is in foreclosure out of every X, like every 29.
It's changed already. We've got a meeting and a follow-up meeting with the secretary, which was kind of freaked out by us or something like that. Well, they wasn't
this
sure.
This is the city of Stockton.
Of Stockton. We were at the city hall, and this was about 5 days ago. And so we had a meeting. They were just a little saying maybe it's not so much of a crisis, you know. But I know the mayor of Stockton and some city councilmen did go to Washington, D.C., to try to actually figure out what they're going to do about this crisis, because it was one out of every 29 homes was in foreclosure. And so about 5 days later now, we get back to this office, and it's kind of the same thing, and we say, do you know what's happened in the last 5 days? It's now to 27 for everyone. And she's like, okay, it's a crisis, took some literature and wanted to study this emergency bill. So we're seeing that type of penetration where we have people in the regions going to all your state legislators, and then in D.C., they're immediately going to then the congressmen in the same area.
So, and do you mind recounting then, where have you been, where have been the concentrated, or where are some of the target states that you're crossfiring into Washington, D.C., besides Texas?
A lot, so far, has been Pennsylvania, mm-hmm. and the Midwest in general.
And say. Michigan and
yeah.
Ohio.
Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania.
Oh, New England.
The New England area, too, as with them.
Right. Well, should we jump, come back and forth on this? That, Chris, you were leading the charge then with other people with the LaRouche Youth Movement in Austin, Texas. Could you go into that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, we're just part of one of the, I mean, down here in Texas, part of one of the locals that was actually involved in this, basically putting pressure on the state and local governments to then coordinate with the federal government to basically just to get a bill passed in the federal Congress that would at least put a number on it. So in the event that the crisis does escalate in the next, say, you know, by the end of September, October, there's a bill that's actually there in the Congress that can be debated. And so that was mainly the main focus of what we were doing going into Austin, into the state legislature. And we mainly met with the representatives because the representatives in there are more closely tied to, say, the city and the county and the people in the homes and whatnot. They do all the casework and whatnot. The unfortunate thing, though, is that the Texas government doesn't meet but, you know, 6 months every 2 years. So they just got out of session now, and their next session is not going to be until about 2009, I think, January of 2009. So the big thing we were getting people to do was basically put pressure, if they can, in any way to issue statements or hold town meetings or get in touch with, you know, people on the local levels to then put pressure on, say, the federal congresspersons and whatnot in these local areas. One example we had that we were using in the state legislature was our representative. I'm not going to go through who he is or his name or anything like that, but he had recently had his home burglarized, and he had shot the person that was burglarizing his house. And this was quite interesting because it was a big, you know, kind of a big scandal and whatnot. And he did a very simple thing. All he did was he took a statement. he typed up a statement, and he sent it to all his constituents. And we sort of use that as an example, saying, well, this is how easy it is to actually effectively get out the word to your people, to, so you can see, so you can start a communicative dialogue between your constituents and yourself. And there were various other examples, of course, you know, having town hall meetings, and then, of course, going to meet with some of the people in the Federal Congress's office. Well, I mean, just to get down to some details, though, going into these offices, we first had a series of very, you know, carefully scheduled meetings, and then we had a lot of impromptu meetings where we just walked into people's offices and said, hey, what are you doing? We got a mortgage crisis on our hands. We need to talk about it. And we had a lot of very effective meetings that way. And when we got into the offices, we had to make clear the nature of this, the crisis that we're in. Because a lot of these guys had heard about, you know, mortgage foreclosures. There's a problem here, there's a problem there. They heard the New York Times. They saw it on, you know, they Googled it and whatnot. And they saw that there was, you know, there were some foreclosure problems, and it was becoming a pretty big issue pretty quickly. But most of the efforts that were done in the legislature were, you know, for instance, to try to do something about it. There weren't anything but educating people on what the nature of predatory lending was, how to know how to, you know, invest, to take out a mortgage and whatnot, basically to make people more aware of what a subprime is and this and that. So that was the knowledge that these guys had of the crisis. We came in there, we basically made it clear that that is, it's not an event-driven crisis, that it's not because you have all of a sudden people foreclosing their homes that there's a crisis. We made clear to them that the nature of the system itself has been predatory lending and usury over the, you know, basically since 1971, when LaRouche had made his first forecast about how Nixon, the Nixon administration, would remove the dollar off of gold, and the fact that we would move from an industrial economy to a pure paper speculative economy, basically a casino. And then that's the nature of the system right now. And that here are all these banks holding mortgages, a lot of them from people who can't afford to pay their mortgages, that are basically functioning like casino chips. Like, you know, you go into a casino and you gamble and you get these, you know, these chips that say, you know, the casino owes you money. The problem is the casino is going out of business right now, and those chips are turning out to be worthless. And when they got wind of this and they actually understood what this was, then a lot of these guys, you know, were like, had just had questions, a lot of questions, like, what are we going to do about this? Like, what can we do? You know, what do you mean mortgage-backed security? What is a mortgage-backed security? You know, how are we going to get people to stay in their homes? What are they going to do? And which were a lot of very good questions. And we, you know, we answered their questions very thoroughly. And they... of course, we were going to get these guys to actually sign on to Lynn's bill. There were a few people who were going to sign on to it. We have to have a follow-up with these guys, of course, because they have to become more educated about the nature of the crisis. And that, of course, that this firewall that Lynn is calling for in his eight-minute address was absolutely the first necessary step in a basically a stopgap measure to, you know, basically just prevent millions of people from going homeless, while we then begin to reorganize the entire financial system around what, like what Franklin Roosevelt did during the Great Depression, which a lot of people responded to. A lot of people in the legislature responded to this idea of going back to an FDR-style economy, because, you know, they sort of understand that this paper economy just doesn't work anymore. Even the Republicans that we met with, you know, some of them are, of course, you know, just pure free market, you know, mystical, you know, voodoo witch doctor, you know, belief in this free, pure free market, which all happens to now being is being bailed out now by the federal government, which is sort of ironic. But a lot of the Republicans we met with are they responded because, you know, you had a lot of farmers in, let's say, North Texas, who had been affected severely by the you know, for instance, the shrinking of the Ogallala Aquifer and these type of things, and that, you know, you can't recharge an aquifer on a paper economy. You have to have infrastructure. And there was responses there. So even the, you know, what you think of as this unstoppable Republican machine, you know, these guys are actually listening, who are not the crazy Bush neoconservatives. So a lot of that went good. A lot of people even remember this. A lot of these legislators, it's fresh in their memory what happened in the late 1980s. with the S&L crisis in Texas, when you had a lot of the savings and loan banks, the majority of them that went out of business were here in Texas, and hundreds of thousands of people lost their homes because of this. And I'm sure John's going to go through some of that in his discussion. But that's fresh in their memory of a lot of these guys. And so, and there were even a lot more in-depth discussions that we had, for instance, with some of these legislative aides and chief of staffs that themselves were, for instance, investors and knew the nature of the markets and whatnot. They knew what a mortgage-backed security was. They knew what an ARM was. They knew that people were being screwed. They knew what IMF policy was towards, say, third world countries, which is also predatory lending, which is, as we pointed out, was the nature of the system. And we had some very good fights with some of these guys. Like, for instance, the difference between the Federal Reserve, which we have now, which is basically bankrupt, and a national bank, which our founding fathers started, and what Alexander Hamilton had started. And, you know, one of these guys was, and here's an interesting thing, one of these guys said, well, what's wrong with the Federal Reserve? Because you know that before we had the Federal Reserve, people had to go borrow money from J.P. Morgan. And that guy was a total crook. And, you know, you just had to make him, you had to say, well, listen, here's the issue. The Federal Reserve itself is not loyal to our government. The Federal Reserve is loyal to people, basically to central bankers and the City of London, which this guy said, this aide we were talking to said, yeah, I know what the City of London is. It's not the city metropolis of London. It's basically London's Wall Street, to try to make the analysis, right? And he said that's who they're loyal to. So they're not loyal to the general welfare or the people. They're loyal to people, basically an oligarchy, which actually he, the guy we were talking to, used that term oligarchy. And he was sort of blown away by Lynn's forecast of this. And at the fact that a national bank, to contrast to the Federal Reserve, a national bank actually loans out credit issued by our federal government to build up large-scale capital-intensive infrastructure projects for the future development of its population at low interest rates, not usurious interest rates, which are going to all of a sudden fluctuate and bankrupt people and make people homeless. And that was really some of the better discussions we had with people. And, of course, there was a lot of other discussions involved in that. But to give you the idea, basically, that's where things stand. And, of course, we're going to be following up these guys in the by Monday and the next couple of days after that to come.
Well, let me just throw this right in here. Richard has emailed from Texas in the last few minutes for you three guys. A particular question following the kind of coverage you're getting on national media like CBS MarketWatch about how the U.S. banks that are involved in big trouble over this home mortgage bubble bursting, having gone to the Federal Reserve discount window and borrowing, getting billions of dollars in recent days. But let me just throw out Richard's question. He said, is this discount window of the Federal Reserve just another term for Fed bailout of what Mr. LaRouche calls, rightfully so, the hedge fund gamblers? So I'm throwing that mostly, I guess, to John Hoeffel, because you might want to take off on that, John, about what we're up against here with the hedge funds, what they are, and their lobby trying to, what they're trying to do here to retain their, as they expire, let's put it that way. Go ahead.
All right. Well, the hedge funds are basically, the whole idea is that the financial markets are geared towards smashing the nation state. That what they have in mind, even though they're completely bankrupt and they know it, their idea is that they want to make sure that the politicians don't interfere, that they have a free rein to do whatever they think they need to do to protect themselves. And, you know, the needs of the hedge fund are not exactly the needs of the people. And this is a continuation of a long battle. I mean, basically, if you take it from 1971 and the taking the dollar off of gold, you look at the blowout of the Texas banking system that Chris referenced, you look at the whole rise and fall of the junk bonds, the stock market crash of 87, we've been careening from one disaster to another ever since we decided to deindustrialize the United States. And now we've reached a point where the whole system is blowing up. And the choice before us is to either go back to something that worked before, go back to an FDR-type policy, or to watch this whole thing disintegrate. I mean, I think that if you look at just in the most recent developments, for example, it's very significant that we now have this bank run at Northern Rock, this mortgage bank in England, because, you know, this is not an isolated event. This is like the subprime stuff. This is not an isolated case. This is the nature of the system today, that the banking system is, in fact, blowing up.
Yeah, John, let me interject here. People may have any newspaper you pick up around the United States, it tends to carry a wire photograph of people waiting in line outside branches of this British bank called Northern Rock. It's now, I think they're calling it Northern Rick. But there's a run on the bank. People are desperate to try and get their money out. And this is just really, I mean, there are four banks that have been like that in Germany. But go ahead on Britain, please.
Okay, so the problem with the runs is the bankers and the hedge fund guys have this illusion that they can control the collapse of the system. And that's a fantasy. But one of the things that will absolutely spin it completely out of even their fantasy of control is the idea of a run. Because their whole idea behind managing it is that people will do predictable things. They can force certain losses on groups of people. They can deal with certain things in that way. But when you get into the dynamic of a run, then all hell breaks loose, and you can't control it. And that's one of the reasons why this thing can't really be controlled. And so you have LaRouche just made the point that the Cayman Islands was now full of dead crocodiles. Because the Cayman Islands is basically the financial equivalent of a crack house. It's a place where it's an unregulated area. It's a lawless area where all these hedge funds and other types of funds and banks, dope money banks and all sorts of things can operate. And this has been sort of a staging ground for assaults into the United States to get rid of what's left of our financial system. And so the fact that these hedge fund guys are now coming out and saying, you know, you have to listen to us, you know, draws the battle line is very clear.
Let me ask you, John, too. Kevin has referred to this about the LaRouche Youth Movement over on Capitol Hill. There's big PR companies. One of them's called Ogilvy now. Maybe it had a different name. The hedge funds are just pouring money into PR agents stalking congressmen on Capitol Hill. Is that right? And these hearings.
Yeah. And basically, this is the city of London. This is the British Empire. And what they're trying to do is to take the world back to the modern equivalent of a British East India Company rule, where we don't have nation states anymore. Basically, they're colonies and satrapies, and it's all controlled by these imperial trading companies. And, you know, of course, this has been Felix Rowan's life's work, this so-called mergers and acquisitions, which is really a euphemism for building cartels. And they've been building this whole series of corporate cartels over the past 30 years or so. And now you see, you know, with globalization, you know, that every nation is now dependent upon these cartels for some of the necessities of life. And this is one of the ways in which they intend to control nations, including our own.
And on this question of the trying to bail out federal action through the Federal Reserve or the European Central Bank to just... one image is, you know, throw gasoline, cold gasoline on a hot fire. It's insane. But there has been money going not just to banks, but is it in the case of Europe to non-bank entities? This is a rumor.
I think that's true, yeah, that they're not only providing money into the banking system, but they're also the Federal Reserve and the Bank of England now in the case of the Northern ROC, is taking in mortgage-backed securities and asset-backed commercial paper and other things, which are just junk. They're taking it out of the market. And I think there's a process going on. We'll see more when the big investment banks start announcing their third quarter results. But I think they're going to wind up writing a lot of these things off and trying to use the quote-unquote subprime crisis as an excuse to get rid of some of this paper and take some losses and, you know, blame it all on the greedy subprime guys. But overall, they're not trying to pump the bubble back up and save the bubble. What they're trying to do is provide enough liquidity to allow transactions to settle and to avoid having the banks and funds and others have to dump this worthless paper on the market, because every time you try to sell it, the value goes down because nobody wants to buy it. You know, we saw this when Merrill Lynch tried to sell the collateral it seized from these Bear Stearns hedge funds, and that when it tried to sell it, it could only get 50 cents on the dollar, and they had to stop. Not because they didn't want to take the loss on the paper, but because of the implications of showing the world that the paper wasn't worth what it was being carried at.
Well, let me throw out one question to Chris there in Texas. Have you compared notes with some of the LaRouche Youth Movement teams that were in Lansing, Michigan, or Boston, Massachusetts, where I think that Boston went for big impromptu meetings, as I understand it. And Boston is one of the big cities with a very high rate of foreclosures among households.
Yeah, they just started out. I mean, the week before they made a bunch of calls, and they said it was very unsuccessful. I mean, it's worked in other parts of the country. They said we were able to set up many meetings, but here with the phone calls, they got almost zero meetings. So the next day they send about 10 people, or a dozen or so, to the state house, and they had 36 meetings that day, and plus got a few follow-up meetings. So it's just a matter of, you know, what we do best is really just keep being creative and thinking of how to make things work. So just...
Yeah, I also think our LaRouche Youth Movement up in Boston had this... resolution passed in the state Democratic Party as well, which was probably a big, in terms of ammunition. That's actually a very powerful thing.
Right, and people should know. Let's just repeat it. And then there was a resolution on the housing crisis passed in California through the LaRouche Youth Movement's effort, the Franklin Delano Roosevelt Legacy Club-based effort.
Mm-hmm. It was in the Los Angeles County Democratic Central Committee, which I think is the largest Democratic Party organization in the country.
So it's almost like you have these seismic, you're having shocks. We haven't had the one big earthquake to get on this. But, and Kevin or Chris, you might want to mention again that this in the case of Missouri, the Missouri legislator, her name is Juanita Walton from St. Louis. She has a resolution for the December annual meeting of the National Caucus of Black Legislators, which is it's in its 31st or 37th year or something like that. So her resolution calls for this kind of action, and that is on the LaRouchePAC.com site. So there is a takeoff potential here. But what about the upcoming states? Is there anything special people should know, like Ohio this week or other target areas?
I think it's a general thing, which is the real takeoff is going to be, because what we found in Michigan, I know we had a couple from one day. They did find another state legislator that would introduce it, and a bunch in a group that were actually talking to each other would be like, yeah, if he introduces it, our sign on to it. So you get, unfortunately, you get a lot of people like that, like, you know, with how the Kucinich bill started for impeachment. It's just a matter of getting that person to make the breakthrough move, especially a United States congressman, and then we can really see this thing take off.
Is this what you're talking about, the multiplier effect, or not?
Yeah, because we're building up a certain groundswell, And from this, I mean, it's how I think in a dynamic way we're going to get a congressman to sign this thing when he sees it.
I mean, I can give an example. Like, we've been doing a lot of organizing here in Houston. We were also, you know, we did a number, people know us from, you know, various things such as, you know, getting rid of Tom DeLay and whatnot right here in the local area. So when we met with certain people in the state legislature, the aides that we met with, they knew people who we knew in different locations that we had spoken with before who also knew, say, you know, federal congressmen's offices and people who worked in those offices as well and who we've all talked with before. And so there's sort of a, you know, from all the organizing we've been doing, you know, throughout the, you know, throughout the years, you know, people are familiar with LaRouche and what he's been saying and how he's been right about this crisis as a whole. And, you know, they know each other. So there's things such as that which are, you know, which are dynamic and interesting.
Yeah, there have been fights. People know us from the work Amelia did the last year, the work on the Emergency Recovery Act, the global warming. I mean, we had one office, I know we went into it, and we were telling them, we're at the Rouge, and they're like, you're at the Rouge? Can you guys sit down? So it's becoming an increasing phenomenon where we've had, I mean, almost zero negative, really, effects to what we're doing. I mean, we're becoming so well-known, I think, and just how effective we are, just always on point. Now, Lynn is, I mean, his forecasts are, they're always right. And this is the guy, and when you hit a crisis, I mean, you look for the person that has a solution, which is what people really respond to right now, how we're, you know, we're going into these offices and demanding how we do this. I mean, they're responding, this not to our force or not, but also how we have a solution where nobody else has one. No one really has a solution. They're looking at, you know, which thing to throw money at. They're just looking, you know, who do we throw money at or something like that.
Not even just that, but for instance, you have people who are trying to do good things, right? Mm-hmm. But their understanding of the crisis is like point by point. Huh. In one office that we talked to, a guy was saying, you know, you got all these dots out there. And what I mean by that is you got, say, you know, a person who is experiencing all types of different crises in their life, like, for instance, with their credit cards, with their mortgages, with their, say, their college loans, because we talked to a lot of people on college campuses. But this guy said, you know, this aide we talked to, he said, the problem is people don't understand what connects these dots. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I said, well, you know, Lynn LaRouche wrote a paper called What Connects the Dots? And he said, you guys just connected the dots for me, you know. So the fact that you can get someone who's got a good intention to actually understand it on a higher level, say, for instance, the bookends or the boundary conditions of the system going back to 1971 when they took the dollar off of gold and the end result, which is today, which is the collapse of this paper economy, people begin to get it from the higher standpoint, and they don't begin to look at it as a series of different events that are somehow just things are going bad, but they see that the nature of the axiomatic assumptions which people have about economics governs what happens within the system.
And certainly, Chris, you're down there in Texas, and mm-hmm. John's been there,
yep.
done that. No, but people who then... at least people who may, lawmakers or people of some responsibility who may know that the Federal Reserve and others are pumping out all this money, but it would be like saving Enron, right?
Which we're very familiar with.
Yeah, yeah, right. I mean, do they pick up, I'm asking you, I guess, do they pick up on that well, once they begin to put it all together, it is insane to try and save an Enron that was ruining the whole country anyway.
Well, sure, that's true. They get that, but what hits more close to home with the state legislatures here is the S&L crisis, because that is something that, I mean, basically directly affected people in all these different districts. I mean, John could probably elaborate more on the S&Ls, but people did have questions about, you know, for instance, today's mortgage crisis, what it meant, and, of course, trying to get them to think of it on a higher level. We had to say, basically, you know, in a healthy economy, the way a healthy bank works is that when it gives a mortgage to someone who buys a home, the bank would count that as an asset because that is basically money that is owed to the bank. Okay, no problem. And then it counts the deposits or the savings that people have in that bank as money owed or a debit, right? This is what a debit account is, essentially. The problem is, though, is when they began to deregulate banking, is that banks would then say, okay, here we are holding on to all these mortgages which are worth X amount of dollars, which we don't have, we just have money owed to us, we can now bundle these together and sell them off to other financial institutions as mortgage-backed securities, maybe not at the exact interest rate that we have them as, but we'll be able to make a bit of money very quickly off of doing this. And that's all fine and good, and it's all great until, you know, all of a sudden people just can't pay because they can't afford it. And that whole thing, I mean, that's what people were basically getting at, what we were getting at with the people in the legislature. And then when they heard that, they basically said, well, that sounds a lot like the S&L crisis we had here in Texas. And what we made clear that, yeah, it does sound like the S&L crisis, but today the entire economy is dependent upon mortgage-backed securities, the CD, the credit derivatives obligations, and all these basically forms of what we called funny money that's floating around out there. And that's really, I mean, that's really what hit these guys right at home, I think.
John, you want to throw in something about the nature of the S&L crisis? Because it's certainly apt as predatory.
Well, the S&Ls were a protected form of bank, which were created to make home loans. And if you make home loans, then you have to have a stable, steady economy in order to do that. Because you're issuing loans, you know, a 30-year loan at a fixed interest rate. And so then the cost of your deposits, so people would make deposits in the S&Ls. The S&Ls would take those deposits and issue loans for them. And S&Ls were prohibited by law from engaging in all sorts of speculation, which was a good thing. That's what allowed them to work. And then Congress, under pressure from the banks, then changed the laws and let S&Ls begin engaging in speculation. And then when that happened, then the hot money guys moved into the S&L business and started speculating with deposits and offering, in order to raise deposits, they would offer higher interest rates than the real S&Ls could offer. And so the S&L business basically blew up, because if you either the S&Ls would have to start speculating, in which case they would cease to be making home loans, or they couldn't get the deposits they needed because the deposits were going towards the hot money banks that were paying more. So the whole S&L system was destroyed in this way through deliberate deregulation. And it is the destruction of that S&L system, of which Texas was ground zero, and the whole Texas commercial banking system also blew out in the 1980s, but it was the destruction of the S&Ls which paved the way for the kind of real estate games that we've seen recently, which have now blown up, where you have, because the idea was to use real estate to keep jacking the price of real estate up in order to create increased debt flow in the form of mortgages, which then could be fed into the banking system. And then through the use of mortgage-backed securities and CDOs and all of these other things, could be multiplied and leveraged and then used as speculation. So the real estate prices, in effect, became the fuel for this whole speculative machine. And because in order for this to work, the prices have to keep going up, 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 up all the time. And at the same time, because of the nature of the financial system, the wages, the ability of the ordinary American to pay these real estate prices was declining. And so along about 2005, this whole thing started blowing up because the prices started getting so high that people just couldn't afford it anymore.
But John, that's also where these banks started giving out the subprime mortgages and the ARMs and these type of things, basically to people who couldn't afford the stuff, just to make the prices to keep going up, right?
Yeah, that's it. The whole idea of the subprime crisis is that this was the way the banking system was changing the rules, loosening restrictions, so that they could continue to make loans and keep this money coming in. So the idea that this was some little subprime lenders operating on the side and greedy homeowners that caused this problem, that it wasn't a problem of the banking system, it wasn't a systemic crisis. It was an isolated crisis out here on the edge, which is then having some sort of contagion into the system itself, and the system, of course, being otherwise healthy. This is total nonsense, because this is all caused by the demands of the system itself. It's all internal to the needs of the system. And that's what's blowing up.
Right. We have a question from California. Two emails came in from the same gentleman, and Rio Cortes. But, John, they concern this inquiry from this emailer is that how is it that a lot of Americans don't know that the Federal Reserve is not in the Constitution, it's private? But the second thing concerns Congress. He asks about if you have this... if you have this lobby that for the hedge funds or for the funny money gang that's so intensely operating now, the kinds of things they're doing are what? They're saying that there should be no regulation. They're saying it was just a limited subprime. They're doing all these things to control what the hearings are, to delimit what the hearings are going into. Is that right?
Yes. I mean, as far as the Federal Reserve, you know, this is all known. It's just that people don't think about these things. People don't really want to know how these things work. But it's all out there for anybody who wants to look, although much of what's being said is said from a populist standpoint. And the question of what the hedge funds are telling Congress is really no different than what we went through in the period around 1993 when Henry Gonzalez, the chairman of the House Banking Committee, was investigating the operations, the derivatives operations. And all of the big banks then testified. They put pressure on the government and said, you know, leave it alone. We're the experts. We know how to handle it. You don't know what you're doing. Trust us. We'll deal with this. If you get involved, it's going to blow up. Now, one of the great ironies of this is that one of the people who testified on behalf of the derivatives trade group, the ISDA, was a guy named Mark Haedeke, who was an official of Enron. You know, so here's a good example of someone who says, trust us, we know what we're doing. And then, you know, they blow up. And the banks are doing the same thing. This whole idea that these guys know what they're doing is a fraud, because we're going from disaster to disaster. You know, and the Federal Reserve has been slamming on the accelerator to feed money into the system, and then that creates a crisis, and then it slams on the brakes, and we've just been careening along. And these guys don't know what they're doing. They're like crack addicts who the only thing they know is they have to have the next hit.
Well, let me ask you, John, you've been keeping a log, is that right, though, of how, in fact, these addicts, these apparently powerful types, They're bankrupt. They're going under. Is that right? You have a list of names you've been publishing.
Well, I have some names. I think the question of how bankrupt these things are, you know, any figure that you see about losses is probably way out of date by the time you see it.
Yeah. For example, I got to give you an example. There was an office we met with, and we were giving out your article, John, to these legislatures. The article that debt is not an asset. And we showed the guy this list of these companies that you'd put in there. And I told the guy, I said, you notice there's no figures on there? And he just yelled. He's like, how can you put a number on these things, you know?
Well, that's anyway. Good. That's good. That shows the guy's thinking.
Right.
You know, because this, you can't quantify these things. You have this systemic crisis. And the whole system, this question of debt is not an asset. The whole system is based upon debt. We've been operating as an economy in the United States below break-even for about four decades now. And as we take down the productive end of our economy, as it collapses more and more, and practically in free fall at this point, that the way we've covered that up is by increasing the debt. So we've gone from being a lender to the world to a borrower from the world. And right now, so far in the 2000s, you know, we're now borrowing, we're going about $5 in debt for every $1 increase in GDP. And So we're buying our profit, so to speak, at $5 per dollar of profit. And the GDP at this point, growth of GDP, is almost 90% services. You know, so we don't really have much of an economy left. We have all this debt that can never be repaid. And what the banks have done is they've taken the debt, and of course, in accounting terms, somebody's debt is somebody else's asset. So they treat all this debt as assets, and then they speculate in the assets, and they flip it back and forth among each other, and they live off the fees from all this flipping. And that's what we call our economy. And, you know, at a certain point, in this game of musical chairs, the music stops, because you can't just keep building up debt and never paying it back.
And there's not enough chairs for people to sit down.
There's not enough chairs.
One thing we mentioned, Enron, we've mentioned other aspects of the last 40, 50 years of this degradation into a casino. Chris, did you find in Austin, in any of the particular districts whose offices you talked to, where there was also new receptivity or new insight to facing this crazy Felix Rowett and stuff, like about your Trans-Texas corridor selling off tollway rights in Texas, the Felix Rohatyn part of the world scam, that there should be allowed to be, in the name of public-private partnerships, a certain grab for control over infrastructure by private interests. Did you pick up on any of that or not?
Actually, there wasn't much of that being picked up. It was mainly this discussion of the homeowners crisis and what that meant in terms of the financial system. But what was interesting is there was a lot of questions on how should the government be involved in remedying the crisis. And, of course, you know, there was a lot of things said, what are you going to just let people stay at their homes for free? You know, people aren't going to pay. You know, they don't deserve that. That's it's their fault. You get a lot of that type of talk. But, you know, we did clear up a lot of things, saying, you know, look, it's going to be the state's job to basically delegate which homeowners pay what banks, meaning that, you know, instead of them paying, going on, say if they had an ARM, they're paying $300 a month, and then all of a sudden their payment goes up to $1,800 a month after a year or two. You basically say, you know, instead of kicking them out of their home, you basically would, you know, figure out some way that they could pay some sort of a rent in which they can just at least keep them in their homes until we can figure out what to do. I mean, there was a lot of talk like that. Of course, you had some free market advocates and whatnot, but the irony of pointing out that the federal government is now trying to bail out the free market, which is collapsing, was pretty big irony. It really enraged some people. But the majority of it was actually very straight talk and very honest discussion, and a lot of people, I mean, some of these guys got really passionate about trying to figure out what to do. So.
And what's your next move, Chris? You said it before, to continue to get back and engage and work on it.
We're going to have a lot of discussions coming up in the next week. One of these, you know, a few guys in the legislature, we even encouraged them to have meetings with people they knew in the legislature to discuss these ideas. That was heavily discussed. Of course, we're going to follow up. We're going to have meetings. Harley Schlanger here in Texas, who's very familiar with a lot of the history of this crisis, will actually be following up some of these legislators as well. But it's really good that we have a youth movement that can go in there and talk to these guys, because one thing we made clear to them, which was very important, is that we're not just in here lobbying the legislator to do something, but we're on college campuses and we're going door to door and we're talking to people on the streets, and we know what people are thinking. And it's up to you to become a leader of these people and not blame people saying, you know, people are just stupid, they don't know what they're doing, they never listen, you have to have a total crisis before things actually change, and yada yada, and so on and so forth. And this, that type of, you know, desk job pessimism, you know, we just overthrew it, you know. So
one particular thing on campuses, let me ask you and Kevin, Chris, mm-hmm. that the LaRouche Youth Movement Saturday update today from their war room, about some of the mood among some of the students met this September, you know, since campus has just opened in the last 2 or 3 weeks,
mm-hmm.
are that many more students are being encountered. They're there, but some of them over the summer, in a couple of cases, their families had lost their homes. And we had 2 or 3 instances of that reported. Did you find, you or Kevin, no, seeing, in other words, the situation is very different from even last June.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, a lot of students, either they themselves, their own family, or at least know somebody that where this is happening. So it's hard to, no matter what kind of, you know, events you may be in, whatever your, how you, if you look at the news or something like that, or who your friends are, what your parents do, there's really, you can't hide from it. It is what we're finding. So people are doing, will respond very quickly or want to at least talk to us about it. So,
you know, the funny thing is let's say, to add to what Kevin said, funny thing is a lot of these students who went and got these degrees and paid, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars for them usually went to go hide at their parents' house. And now their parents don't have a home to go hide at, so they got to face reality.
Yeah, reality's really out there.
It sure is.
And among those 100 cities, again, we didn't reiterate this throughout the show, but people, anyone listening, this will be archived, people listen on the telephones, know that it's a time for putting resources to back this LaRouche Youth Movement-led effort in the United States, besides everything internationally. And it's still a question of getting out the, there's a flyer going out by the hundreds of thousands on the Homeowners and Bank Protection Act of 2007. So people can look for that on www.larouchepac.com. And also look on www.larouchepub.com for the breaking news as it comes up, as well as on LaRouche PAC, from this conference in Germany that's international on world reconstruction, which is part of the world transition to rebuilding the economy that's now otherwise collapsing in this chaos. And, John, do you have any sense of timetable about the the financial side of things with the resetting some of these adjustable rate mortgages, the subprime, or the plain old fact that September 30th is the end of the financial year for the federal government, among other things? There's certain timings to look for. Do you have anything to watch out for there?
Well, I think all of this is being determined by the pace of the economic collapse, because depending on how fast that goes, is going to have a much greater determination than the question of some of these resets and things like that, because the whole system is, in fact, blowing up. And so, forecast about what's going to happen is like all the forecast of foreclosures. You know, this is all linear based upon things remaining as they are or maybe getting a little bit worse. And nobody's, when they make these things, they don't actually understand that we're in a period in which there are going to be great shifts and things will get much worse, much more quickly than anyone imagines.
Right. We have the emailer from California again asks about not being enough chairs when the music stops for the musical chairs. But he says, is there a way to picture it in the physical economy? Once nobody trusts the physical economy, are people going to run to cash in on physical goods? Let me throw in here then, John, or Chris or Kevin. You also see all kinds of patterns like wild speculation in food commodities, besides the fact that we'd have a genuine scarcity because of the agriculture takedown for 40 years, or speculation in fuel. Is that what you say is part of it?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So it's already upon us. It isn't like in the future. You could say this is just beginning unless we turn it around.
Yeah, it's a global problem. People should know that. And should think of the 1648 Treaty of Westphalia, which is, Lynn put out a statement just a week ago or so on the Housing and Banking Act. And how people, they live in states, they live in communities, like they don't live in these districts. And so, and looking at the top 100 list, a lot of these cities have 4 or 5 or 6 congressmen kind of dividing the city up. I mean, they can't say, I mean, how people want to try to, people, a lot of these guys say they want to take care of their community first or something like that, and they don't have time to work with other people. It's like, how can you say you don't have time to work with even another congressman? That's a part of your city. That's like a part of your body. But globally, we're like a body. So you can't just neglect any of it. And so we're just, I mean, keep doing what we're doing, and we're bringing, you know, this world together right now.
Right. Well, this is taking up us up to the very last few seconds, and I want to thank Kevin, John, and Chris, and point out that September 22nd, be sure again to tune in to the weekly LaRouche Show at from 3 to 4 in the afternoons, live every Saturday, Eastern Time out of the United States. Harley Schlanger will be on, and I hope then we can have some of the delegation or some people who directly participated at the Germany conference that's still going on right now in Kiedrich on the Bering Strait and the Eurasian land bridge reconstruction perspective for the whole world. And the last emailer, I thank you from California, Richard again, for, or from Texas, I beg your pardon, for raising the buffoonery point that Alan Greenspan's now being interviewed for his new book all over the media, saying, sorry, he just didn't know what was happening. What do you think, John?
Well, I think he's saying, I'd rather be thought of as an idiot than the man who blew up the world.
Okay. Okay, down with the idiocy, and best wishes to everyone this week to force this shift in Congress. Thank you all for participating.